beta function of these models we've been discussing. Well, actually, and first I wanted to answer a question from the last time. So last time we had like chiral theory cross an anti-chiral theory, may or may not be the same one. And then we had a JJ bar perturbation. So somebody asked last time if when we deform this theory in this way, are there any conserved currents? Because we'd expect an integral model to have an infinite number of conserved currents. And the answer is that inside of T, inside of the operators of T, there is those operators O such that the OP between the current and O is non-singular. Now, more or less, this is these operators form the what's called the coset of this chiral algebra. And what happens is that when you perturb this theory, these guys remain in the kernel of del W bar. So at first order in perturbation theory, this is obvious, because we saw last time that del W bar O gets a correction of the form J bar times something involving the way the current acts on O, because that's the way that the operator transforms. But if there's no non-singular OP, then this is zero. And in fact, if you, from the analysis at the quantum level, these operators remain to all orders the kernel of dw bar and define an infinite number of conserved currents. Depending on what T we start with, there might not be any such things. If we start with T being the chiral WZW model itself, then this won't be anything. So, but if we start with some other T, this will be some interesting collection of operators. Maybe I might expand a bit on that later. Okay, so I'm going to answer that question. So now we want to understand the beta function. So the first thing to understand are the OBEs between J and itself in a chiral theory. So here's the formula. You may have seen before in other contexts. JA at 0 times JB at W, the singular term of the OBE looks like 1 over W FABC JC plus K over W squared delta AB, where K is the level. Okay. Have you guys seen this formula before in the context of string theory? Yeah. So there's this beautiful story about once we have these currents, the algebra, the modes of these currents satisfy. Currents which satisfy this equation define an action of the Kasmoody algebra, a certain infinite dimensional Lie algebra, which has a parameter called the level, that's at this level. We don't really have time to say anything about the general story, but I can say, I can explain where this formula comes from. What's that?
Is the level an integer?
Yes. If you start with a unitary theory, the level is a positive integer. There are some slightly formal theories, in which the level can be rational or a complex number. But in something where you write down a Lagrangian, it will always be a positive integer. Okay, so suppose here's the example. If we start with these n complex fermions, then the current is psi j psi I, as we saw before. Now here, the Lie algebra G is the Lie algebra of the unitary grouper, since we're complexifying. Doesn't really matter whether you think of it as UN or GLN. So the index A has been replaced by two indices IJ. And now we can just compute explicitly that this formula holds. So the propagator in this theory, I'm going to drop some factors of pi, which can be absorbed into a normalization. Now let's compute the OPE. Since this is a free theory, this is very easy. I have my, here's J. Here's J. There are two things that can happen. Either one vertex is contracted, or two vertices are contracted when we compute the OPE. So when we can, because the propagator is 1 over w, so it's 1 over w times the thing where one vertex is contracted. And when one vertex is contracted, we have to, you know, this is really 1 over w times a delta function. When a vertex is contracted, we have to contract the indices in the appropriate fashion. So I'll find something like j, I, j, j, k, l, delta j k minus j I j j k l delta I f. So that's the FABC piece. And then there's another term, 1 over w squared. And here, both indices have to be the same, because there's two delta ij's. Yep.
Where does the minus sign come from in the first term?
It comes from flipping the fermions past each other. You pick up a sign when you move them past each other. Right, so if we have psi j, psi I, psi k, psi l, psi k. Actually, I think I got the minus sign. The sign should have been reversed. It doesn't really matter. So when I contract these guys, I just find a 1 over w. But if I want to contract the j and k, say the convention is that when I contract an upper index with the first with a lower index second, I get minus. And if I want to contract j and k, I have to move this guy all the way to the end. So I get another minus. Maybe let's just have a very, very brief aside into the theory of WZW models. So in general, you can have a theory which has these symmetries, but it might have operators which are not built from J. That's the generic situation. Sometimes, however, every operator is built by combining J's in combining J and its derivatives via the OPE. So if every operator is built from J, then, so if, and if also the theory is unitary, the model is equal to chiral Weissmuller-Witten model at level k, whatever the level is. So it turns out there's a uniform construction of all of the chiral WZW models where you start with the group manifold and you do some things. But for certain simpler ones, there can be described as free fermions. And it's kind of this observation will make it manifest that they're free fermions. So for example, UN at level 1 is equal to the n complex fermions. SON at level 1 is equal to n real fermions. Here we only have lower indices. And there's a few other simple cases which have such a description. This is just some general knowledge about this field. Any questions? And in general, there is a theory associated to a group and a number. Yes.
Here in the interval for JJ, shouldn't it be just 1J in the Fourier control? Does that make sense?
Say that again, sorry?
You write equal 1 over boom over W. Shouldn't it be just 1J?
You are absolutely right. I'm really sorry. Thank you. That was a stupid mistake. This should be delta kj jil. That's embarrassing. I wrote it right earlier. And it's clear from this formula there's two psi's hanging around. Okay, so let's go on to compute the beta function. So what we need to do is look at, we need to look for, we will look for one loop logarithmic divergences. So to do this, we'll introduce a coupling constant. So that we have next to the JJ bar term. So to lowest order in C, the diagram to consider I'm getting a bit ahead of myself. Sorry. So we're going to do this analysis in a slightly abstract way. We could have said, let's write down this explicit Lagrangian with fermions and compute explicitly in that Lagrangian. However, I think it's more fun to think about abstract chiral theories and with this perturbation and using only the properties of J, figure out what the beta function is. So the answer is a very universal answer. So the diagrams we're going to write down for instance, integral W1, W2, coupling constant squared, J, J bar, at W1, J, J bar, at W2. Now, what do I mean by this? These guys are operators in whatever chiral and antichiral theories we have. And we're taking the product as operators. So it looks a bit different from the usual Feynman diagram notation. However, the way we translate into usual Feynman diagrams is if we connect, let's write it like this. So an edge will represent, we contract, we use the OPE to replace one copy of J, one pair of copies of J with whatever its OPE is. So we replace So you should think that you know if we were starting with a concrete model where I really had chiral and antichiral theories, the OPE is obtained by literally putting a propagator connecting two fermions. So this is just a natural generalization of that. So let's do the computation of the first diagram, which is the only one that's interesting for us. Is that W1? This is at W2. And we're going to do the integral over W1 minus W2 less than equal. It's greater than or equal to epsilon. So we have this, we're not allowing these points to touch because we need to introduce a UV regulator in order to make this integral well-defined. And what we're going to be interested in is the singular behavior in epsilon. Okay, so since we've written two lines, we must be performing two OPEs, one on J and one on J bar. Let me write these indices. Oh, give me two and the JJ bar. Okay. So there, what we're going to do is we place the product of these expressions into the integral and figure out what the singular terms are. So we'll substitute into the integral, and we'll say v equals w1 minus w2. What we find is four terms. The first one is FABC, FABD, JAW1, J bar, DW1. One times integral dv bar over, let's collect the singularities from this one and this one, v squared. Okay, so this is the first term, and then there's three more. So are there any questions about how we do this computation? Okay, so okay, so what are the other terms? There is one that's like FABCJCW1. Times the integral d times delta AB. However, this one is zero because FABC is antisymmetric in AB, and delta AB is symmetric. So this is just zero. And similarly with the third term, the only other term is delta AB. Integral dv dv bar over v to the fourth. See if you got this right so far. Okay. But as I said, if you find it confusing that we're writing things in this abstract setting, you're really not going to lose very much by thinking about a concrete setting of some fermions. Now, once we have these, once we computed the amplitudes of these diagrams, we should figure out what the singular terms are in epsilon. So let's look at this first diagram. Here, I have vv bar on the top and vv bar on the bottom, and I'm integrating over a plane. This diagram is clearly going to be have a logarithmic divergence. Because, it's basically going to be the integral of 1 over the radius. So this one is clearly going to be of the form log epsilon. And similarly, this one has a VV bar on the top, a VV bar squared on the bottom. So this one is clearly going to be of the order of epsilon, 1 over epsilon squared. So just by dimensional analysis, well, we can even compute the first integral if you really want to. So there's going to be some constants which are not important. Okay. So what does this tell us? So our goal is to compute the beta function. Actually, let me just put in this factor once before I come back to that. So then we have times f a b c. F A B D J C J D R D. So before we go on, I want to. There's a very useful fact in the theory of Lie algebras. That this tensor is delta CD times H check, where H check is something known as the Joule-Coxeter number. So it's some rational number. Which is not equal to zero if I start with an ordinary finite dimensional Lie algebra. Yes, I'll repeat it in indices, yes. So this factor appears anytime you see in a gauge theory, you see this diagram. This you have this kind of index because there's always an FABC at each vertex. So therefore, the first term is also accompanied by delta CD, or delta AB, if you prefer, times some constant. Okay. So we can write them as log epsilon AA J bar A times some constant plus epsilon minus 2 JA J bar A times some other constant. These are the counter terms. The one loop counter terms. Now, sorry, that doesn't have that factor. Okay, so I'd like to explain how to extract the beta function from the counter terms. So I'm sure this is something you guys have seen before in other contexts, but let me just go through the story again a little bit. So what the beta function measures is the failure of your theory to be scale invariant. Now, when we started with a chiral theory and an anti-chiral theory and added on JJ bar, everything we did, nothing we did broke scale invariance. The only point at which we broke invariance under changing of scale was when we introduced the UV cutoff epsilon in these integrals. So the failure of scale invariance should be measured by like figuring out how these guys change when I multiply epsilon by a constant. And that should give us our beta function. However, there is a slightly subtle point. There's a slightly subtle point in this analysis. It turns out that the only thing that matters are the logarithmic terms. The terms with the polynomials do not matter. So let me explain why this is true. So we need to think a little bit more carefully about how we broke scale invariance. So we introduced a cutoff. We figured out what the singular terms were, our counter terms, and then we're going to send the cutoff to zero. But I would argue that the real point at which scale invariance was broken is deciding at which things were singular. I broke the symmetry between, say, epsilon and 2 epsilon by deciding that log epsilon was singular, as opposed to deciding that log of 2 epsilon was singular. They differ by a constant, so it's kind of arbitrary which one you decide is singular. The ones with polynomial decay, though, the epsilon minus 2, the counter term associated epsilon minus 2 is uniquely determined by the fact that the limit as epsilon goes to 0 must be non-singular. Here, because it's kind of arbitrary if I choose log epsilon or log epsilon plus a constant, there's an ambiguity constant term. So if you believe this verbiage, which was a bit vague, we find that the beta function is, again, JA, J bar A. In other words, if C is equal to the coupling constant, we find that the orgy flow looks like C squared del C plus higher order terms. In other words, these theories have an infinite number of marginal deformations. We can add on all kinds of crazy terms, but we're finding that this particular term itself defines a trajectory in the space of theories.
I have a question. So let's say that for some reason we needed to add the log term for the counter terms.
But we didn't need to, yes.
Let's say that it didn't appear. That would mean that the theory would remain invariant under.
Yes, there would be a vanishing beta function to this approximation. Let me say this is a really subtle point. So like in my opinion, like the best kind of conceptual way to think about this stuff is to never mention counter terms. They're just some kind of computational tool that should be buried under the hood and not used to justify any conceptual ideas. So if you want to figure out what the beta function is, you take some operators and you compute how they move when you move the position of the operators. And you compare that. So you should find that in a theory of the form you just said, the algebra, even though it looks like there's counter terms, the algebra of operators will still be scale invariant. Okay, so I wanted to. So I wanted to move on to consider to, you know, I want to use this calculation to figure out what the beta function of a sigma model is. So you guys already should know the answer is this famous computation that the beta function of a sigma model is given by the Ricci curvature. So this calculation we've just done will allow us to figure that out in the case we start with a Kähler manifold, although the general calculation is not much more difficult. So the sigma model on a Kähler manifold has fields beta I, gamma j, beta bar I, gamma bar j, and Lagrangian. So the usual kinetic terms with the chiral and anti-chiral parts, plus the integral of the inverse metric is a function of gamma gamma bar times beta I beta bar j. So since this is exactly the same kind of thing we've just considered, chiral plus anti-chiral times anti-chiral plus some deformation which mixes them, the identical computation will allow us to figure out the answer for the beta function. So what we'll do is we'll write this metric as a flat metric plus a small perturbation. Plus hij. It's a function of u and u bar. And anytime we do this, we're choosing coordinates on the target manifold. So we'll assume that we're in normal coordinates. Hij is a function of u, u bar is quadratic in the u's. So there's this really nice feature of the Ricci curvature. I mean, the Ricci curvature always has a particularly nice form in any Kähler manifold. We're not going to use that, though. We're going to use a simpler fact, which is that if we choose normal coordinates, that the Ricci curvature is obtained by applying the Laplacian to this tensor. So, and again, this is presumably something you've studied in gravitation. The Ricci curvature, ij at u at this particular point, is equal to sum d by uk d by du bar k times hij, all evaluated at u bar equals 0, and times some constant c, but I don't remember. Right, this should be familiar? Or no?
So is this the linearized expansion of the Ricci curvature?
Yeah, like in normal coordinates, it only picks up the second derivative of the metric when you expand the metric.
Essentially, only the derivative terms on the sigma and the gamma are contributing, right? That's what you're
yes, saying. Exactly, because gamma is the first derivative of G. Personally, I find this is the only way I can actually understand the Ricci curvature, because normal coordinates are canonically defined for each point. Then you can just differentiate the metric twice to get a tensor. I don't know, that just is the Ricci tensor. I mean, it has a very physical meaning, because normal coordinates have a very physical meaning. I start at this point and I get my coordinates by sending things off in geodesics. Okay, so how do we find that this will appear in this expansion? So we're expanding Gij as delta ij plus h. So when we compute the beta function, say to first order in h, so the only diagram that contributes is this. Well, firstly, I have this vertex. Because I'm expanding Gij as delta ij plus stuff, I'm going to have this beta I, beta bar I vertex. So here, and this will go over here. And over here, I'll have a vertex, which is maybe the circle is not big enough to write what I wanted to write in it. It looks like h I j gamma gamma bar beta I beta bar j. Okay. So there's two vertices, and the first order in H, the only diagram you'll find is this one. There'll be other ones to second order in H, but that's not that we're going to do this. Kind of, we're going to simplify the calculation by working to lower order in H. Now let's think about what each edge does. Each edge, I contract beta I with gamma I to leave 1 over W1 minus W2, or beta bar I with gamma bar I to leave 1 over W1 bar minus W bar 2. So each edge removes a gamma from here. Therefore, it has the effect of differentiating this function with respect to the variable which depends on. So this diagram gives the integral over of 1 over W1 minus W2 squared times the sum del ui k del du bar k applied to h I j evaluated on gamma times I eta bar j. So this second derivative comes from the contraction of those two edges. So this is equal to, so dropping the non-singular terms, so this is equal to log epsilon times the Ricci curvature times plus non-singular terms, which don't matter, so plus terms which depend on gamma. What's that?
What is the argument of the Ricci curvature? Oh, it's zeroth order?
Yeah, we're evaluating at this point. We're doing perturbation theory around a particular point. Okay, so. So what we've seen so far is we take our sigma model. We will look in normal coordinates around a chosen point, and we calculate the beta function. The beta function will give you some deformation of my sigma model by some metric. If we evaluate this metric at that point, it's the Ricci curvature. You might ask why, well, that's slightly weaker than what you really want. You want to say, if we evaluate this deformation at any point, it will be the Ricci curvature. There's a pretty delicate point in this analysis that was worked out carefully by Friedan in his thesis, and that we won't go into, which is when we suppose here our space of fields has some nonlinear target, some nonlinear sigma model, and our Feynman diagram expansion depends on the coordinates on that target. If you want to work in perturbation theory near a particular point, it's best to use normal coordinates at that point. But those are not normal coordinates at any other point. So you have to think about the effect of the change of coordinates from normal coordinates at one point to another, and how this affects Feynman diagrammatics. So if you work through this, if you work through this kind of slightly delicate point, you will figure out that this argument, where we find the Ricci curvature just at this point, can be upgraded to an argument to show that what we find everywhere is the Ricci curvature. So this is a slightly, what we've derived is a slightly weaker version of the result that is actually true. So in fact, so the beta function is equal to the Ricci curvature everywhere. Okay, so I want to move on to some other topics, but the next thing I wanted to discuss is something about scattering of particles in massive theories. Well, let's just see what our analysis tells us about. Yeah.
So the Benson-Prokhorov models have vanishing beta functions, right? So, but you wrote at some point that these chiral anti-chiral models are essentially equivalent to this.
The perturbations of it. Chiral times anti-chiral. Let's see. The Weissenbinder model is like a conformal fixed point and splits up as chiral and anti-chiral. then we're perturbing it, and we're finding that our first order perturbation is part, well, in the case of a sigma model, it's the Ricci curvature, but in general, it's just part of a trajectory. It flows between one CFT and another CFT, and along the flow, it's integrable. I don't know if anybody knows this story, what this is supposed to do. These flows are supposed to flow between the WN minimal models, where you start at the WZW model, and there's some other CFTs constructed in the 80s by Zamolodnikov and others, and this connects them by a massive flow. Okay. So it's, well, it's supposed to be started with this sigma model. So this theory is asymptotically free. If we calculate the sine of our beta function, well, this theory, of course, the Ricci curvature is just equal to the metric. And just by for symmetry reasons, so if we flow we've considered the family of theories defined by the orgy flow, there's only one parameter, which is just the size of the two-sphere. And as we flow to the IR, the two-sphere gets smaller and smaller. So in this limit, it's asymptotically free. Whereas in this limit, it's believed to be massive. So it flows from a free CFT down to a massive theory. Yes?
I just have a question. Is this related to the Kaler-Ricci flow that you studied in math?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it must be the same. I think if you do the if you write the sigma model in a Kaler manifold in this way, then you must find you'll find a family of Kaler metrics satisfying the Ricci flow equation. So I presume. And similarly, so the gross Neveu. Are the theory models are expected to be massive. So the really annoying part of this story is that, you know, if we worked far off in the UV in perturbation theory around the free theory, we're not going to see anything massive. The massive particles only appear in the IR, and they wrap the whole two-sphere. So they're nothing which lives locally on the two-sphere. They're kind of spread out uniformly over the whole two-sphere, like spherical harmonics. So you can never see them in perturbation theory. So it's going to be a real challenge to use the techniques we've had to say anything about them. Massive particles are non-perturbative. Since I have 5 minutes left, I just want to start a little bit about before we move on to analyze these. Yeah, sorry.
So you're saying that you deform the theory? And this integral deformation will be massive?
Yes, once you move along flow.
But as you flow, these massives are going to get higher and higher, and then they incorporate.
Yes, they get higher and higher, and then they go to infinity. Like, not everything in the theory is massive. So the chiral and anti-chiral, we start with the theory T, as we go along the flow, there's some small number of operators that remain chiral along that flow, the ones in the coset. And as I go along the flow, everything else goes to infinity, and I'm left again with a theory at the end, with a conformal theory with a much smaller algebra of operators and a smaller. So the central charge decreases along the flow, some logic of C theorem. Okay, so what does it mean to be massive? So a signature of like a massive theory is that if an operator O creates a particle, then the two-point function tends to has exponential decay. The m squared. So the two-point function decays very rapidly as I move the position of these guys apart. Now, there might be some massless, I'm not excluding that there are some massless excitations. I'm not saying it's entirely massive. I'm saying there's a lot of massive things there. Now, evidently, in a free fermion model, this does not happen. It decays like 1 over z. And also evidently, no matter how many, if I sum up any finite number of Feynman diagrams, along every edge, I'll have a 1 over z. So the two-point function with the free fermion with the quartic interaction will always have polynomial decay in z at any order in perturbation theory. Somehow magically, when we sum up all these contributions, we're supposed to find this exponential decay. And so it's very, very difficult to see. I think I'll stop there. Next time I'll introduce rapidity and talk a little bit about scattering.